Welcome to the Teacher in Classroom 21, a podcast by the Everlearner. I'm James, your host. Join me and my guests every week as we discuss, debate, and explore the features of a world-class classroom in the 21st century. Hello and welcome to the Teacher in Classroom 21 podcast. I'm your host, James Sims, and joining me from Heerlen in southern Netherlands is Paul Kirschner. Paul is Distinguished Professor at Open Universiteit Netherlands, with a wide expertise in a huge range of educational practices, including learning and instructional design, computer-supported collaborative learning, and media use in education. Paul is also a widely published educational researcher and author with work stemming from the 1970s to today. Paul is, along with Miriam Neerlein, the author of the superb educational blog, Three Star Learning Experiences, an evidence-informed blog for learning professionals. Today, we're going to talk extensively around the concept of feedback in the learning cycle based on Paul and Miriam's blog post, No Feedback, No Learning, which I encourage all listeners to go and read. Paul, welcome to the show.
Now, James, thank you very, very much. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
So, Paul, first of all, do you prefer Paul or Professor Kirschner?
My name is Paul. Well, actually, if you want to say it in Dutch, it's Paul.
Paul, okay.
Okay, but you can call me Paul.
I may merge those ideas together a little.
Okay, very good.
So, Paul, I'd firstly like to ask you why you started the blog Three Star Learning Experiences.
We started it because I originally had a blog in Dutch, and the blog was meant for primarily for teachers in the Netherlands. It was my idea of how you valorize knowledge, empirical knowledge from the educational sciences in a way that teachers can do something with it. At a certain point, there were some people who asked me, why don't you do it in English? And I said, yeah, because it's too much work for me to do it in English. I'm already doing it in Dutch and then translating it. I just don't have the time. I also have a job. And so I went and online in Twitter to try to find someone who wanted to work with me on that. And I found Miriam, who was a Dutch woman, an incredible Dutch woman, who had spent years in the United States and is now in Ireland. And so she was bilingual, I'm bilingual and fluently in both. So it was a strange thing of she would be translating my Dutch blogs into English and also writing her own. And so that's the way it began, in a completely electronic social media type of way that we met each other. And so let's call it the operational way. The more, let's try to call it cerebral, is that we both have a passion for learning design and helping others become proficient in teaching, training, education, those types of things. So we also met each other on that plane. And we needed a name, and we chose the name Three Star, which is rather strange, but not strange, because I used to be a cook and head of a restaurant in another period of my life, and I still cook quite a lot. And so my ideal is a three-star Michelin cook and a three-star restaurant. That's why it's not like five-star for a hotel. And so my analogies are primarily cooking related or carpentry related. I was also a carpenter. And the idea behind it is an excellent teacher is like an excellent chef, and that every teacher should strive to being a three-star teacher. And the metaphor goes even further than that, because I say a top chef is capable of making use of tools, techniques, and ingredients to make a good-looking, tasty, and healthy meal. A three-star teacher has tools, techniques, and ingredients, and is capable of making efficient, effective, and enjoyable learning experiences. So that's how we started our three-star blog, and that's why it became that. And slowly but surely, Miriam threw off her, I don't know if the word is in English, but I'd say she was no longer afraid to put her own thoughts on paper. And what began originally as a simple translation, and every once in a while Miriam would do write something, is now a completely shared blog. And the only way you can see who wrote it is who's the first author on the blog page.
I see. I have to say, just listening to that alone gives me all kinds of ideas about possible follow-ups to this, Paul. So I
just it's yours. It could be today. It could be at another point.
Absolutely.
I don't think you want a podcast for 3 hours.
Well, no, but also I quite like a bit of cooking myself, Paul. So
I wonder
if that might be sort of a less formal conversation sometime.
Oh, definitely. And, no problem. We can exchange recipes.
We can indeed.
Okay.
So Paul, I mean, the blog, which I'm so tempted to move on to posts that you've published even in the last couple of weeks because they're so fascinating. But I want to stick to feedback today. So
okay.
let's move on to that. Let's specifically talk about that post, no feedback, no learning. Paul, what is the link between feedback quality and the development of accurate schema in learners?
It's very, very simple. Feedback it should be seen as a process. The problem is that most teachers see, or most people see, it as a product. But feedback is a process. We see feedback in our thermostats. The room gets too cold. This goes some information to a central heating, and it warms it up. And when it reaches a certain temperature, it shuts it off. So feedback isn't a product, it's a process. And as such, if you see it in that way, feedback can play an enormous role in the learning process, because as it is, learning is also not a product, learning is a process. So you use a process of giving feedback to aid the learning process. And you can use different types of feedback to achieve different things in learners. But the whole idea behind it is, how can we stimulate thinking, processing of information by the learner? Because the processing of information and making stable changes in one's brain, yeah, that is the essence of learning. And that's what feedback can do.
So you mentioned there that there's different types of feedback. And I remember reading in your article as well that I think your exact line was something along the lines of, feedback is not an unambiguous concept. So let's drill down a little bit here. What is formative feedback? And why can we argue that it's more potent than other forms?
Oh, this is very simple. You can't argue that it's more potent. Mm-hmm. You don't say argue it's more potent for learning. Mm-hmm. The whole idea behind the idea of formative as informative assessment, it is assessment for learning, formative assessment. Formative feedback is feedback for learning. There are different types of feedback that don't necessarily aid the learning process. If you just tell a child that he or she was right or wrong, you will affirm whether or not they did it properly or not, but it won't help their learning. If they did it wrong, it doesn't bring you any further. We call that corrective feedback. Okay, James, that was wrong. It's not Herlin, it's Herlin. Okay?
Thank you.
That was wrong. You have a second type of feedback which aids learning a little bit more, and that's directive. You say, well, you did it wrong. You should do it in this way. Yeah? And that's kind of like the two levels that we constantly see in all of the feedback, at least in most of the feedback. I'll try not to be too absolute. In most of the feedback that we see by teachers, by parents, it's either you did it wrong or you did it right. gold star if you did it right, pat on the shoulder. If you did it wrong, do it again. Okay, you haven't learned very much, except that maybe you're dumb, is what you might have learned from it, which isn't the idea of the learning process. You don't want people to think that they're dumb. You want them to think that they can achieve something. With corrective feedback, you tell them how they should have done it. Then you're instructing. Okay, well, that's not much of a problem. That helps in the learning process. Yeah, and you can use that well. The third type is what I call epistemic feedback. And that's feedback that gets people thinking, that helps them create new ideas and new thoughts. Those are the typical W for when, where, why, how, those types of questions. So you can see it in someone carries something out of a mathematical thing, or they have to solve a problem. It's either no, it's wrong, your solution. No, it's wrong, and you should have done it this way. You should have used the quadratic equation instead of that and that. And epistemic is, why did you use that formula? Could you have used another one? What would have happened if you would have done that and that? Why might this be a better way to do it? So you want to get them thinking. Mm-hmm. And it's the interaction, that is that bringing the learning process, that's the formative type of feedback, bringing the learning process, starting that up, and using feedback to stimulate learning and thinking. Yeah, that's why feedback can help and is essential to learning.
So we want to get teachers on this journey from moving from a global concept of feedback into this process of formative feedback. I mean, yeah. How do we move teachers along that journey?
Let them experience that if they do it in another way, that they'll have students who are more, what's the word in English? Who enjoy, have a feeling of success more, which for a teacher, I myself am a teacher, is that feeling that your students have come further is an incredibly enjoyable experience for the teacher. Absolutely. And the feeling of success is incredibly enjoyable for a learner. Some people make the mistake of thinking that motivation leads to success, or that it, at best it's reciprocal. But it's not. Success leads to motivation. You can be very motivated, but if you constantly walk into walls because it goes wrong, sooner or later, and it's often sooner, you're going to lose that motivation to do something. And it doesn't matter if it's playing football or learning in physics or language or cooking or whatever. At a certain point, you'll just stop. If you experience success because someone has helped you with their feedback, they've given you the feeling that you can do something, they've helped you think about it, they've helped you solve that problem, they've brought you further, you'll experience success, and that experience of success is very enjoyable, and that will motivate you to continue to learn. I mean, just take it very simply from someone standing there trying to curl the ball into the goal. We're now sitting in the World Cup week. Yes, I know right. You're probably rooting for.
To a Dutch guy this week, I wasn't going to raise the football with you.
You do it very, very well. We had the joke that after one game, we had as many points as the Germans, and we hadn't even played the game. If you want to learn to curve the ball around a wall of defenders from a free kick, you want to do that. And if you're constantly kicking the ball and you're hitting the wall of people, at a certain point in time, your leg will get tired and you'll get frustrated at it. If you have a good coach who says, well, if you try it in this way, and why should you then put more of the side of your foot into it, and you see that the curl comes into it, all of a sudden it's, hey, I can do it. That type of thing. So the experiencing of success leads to more motivation and to continue and trying harder, and leads to more learning. So how do you get a teacher to do that? Have them experience the success of giving the right type of feedback, formative feedback, feedback that helps learning, and have them experience their learners who are thankful, who are experiencing success. I mean, as a cook, the greatest thing that can happen is you sit down at the table and your family even says to you, boy, that was really delicious tonight, Dad. Yeah, even though it might have been the last things that you had in the vegetable drawer, because tomorrow you're doing your shopping and you take the vegetable that you haven't used, but you've made something, and people say, oh, and that's kind of like a stimulus to continue. The feeling that someone appreciates what you're doing, that you've had success, is the reason to continue to do that. And if everybody says, that was bad, at a certain point in time, you'll stop. And if they don't help you to make it better, that was bad because of this and this, have you thought about using these spices? Yeah. Then you'll stop. Or if you get the right feedback, you'll continue to cook and become a better cook.
There's a couple of really, it makes my mind jump to a couple of things that I almost feel in the educational cycle. It's, first of all, learning is a true natural high, maybe one of the greatest natural highs that we can have. And clearly feedback, and we'll explore it in more detail in a moment, but clearly feedback is really central to that process. But it also brings me to this point, Paul. You speak very passionately here. I mean, we're getting quite close to the ideas here that the very concept of being an expert teacher is actually defined by the quality of their feedback. How do you feel about that?
Defined by the yes, in a indirect way. The indirect way is as follows. John Hattie did a really nice study in 2003, in which he defined the difference between an expert teacher and an experienced teacher. And the defining characteristic of an expert teacher is that he or she has a deep conceptual knowledge of the domain in which he or she is studying, teaching in, and also of teaching as a profession, as a trade. The reason for that is, if you have this deep conceptual knowledge, you're capable of thinking on your feet. You're capable of explaining something in five different ways. You're capable of thinking up new tasks to help your students, because you deeply understand the domain in which you're working. You also, as I said, you have the tools, techniques, and ingredients to teach it properly. You say, well, I think I should introduce it in this way, and I think I need to give these types of tasks. Now, this deep conceptual knowledge of both teaching, but also of the domain in which you're teaching, allows you then to give good feedback. If you don't understand your own, that's why I say it's indirect. If you don't understand the domain you're teaching, it makes it very hard to give good feedback, because you've learned a trick. And you can only give good feedback when you really understand why and how and when certain things happen in your own domain. And if you don't understand that yourself, you can't ask it of the student, how and when and why. We see that quite a lot with elementary school teachers who, let's say, don't understand mathematics and only go through the motions and teach tricks to their students, but don't have the deep conceptual knowledge of mathematics to ask the type of questions that you need to give proper feedback, because you have to understand, why certain answers might be system mistakes. Yeah? I mean, you see something and you should understand, oh, that's because the person understands mathematics in this way, and that's not the proper way. So if I ask it in that way, I'll be able to get past the system mistake that they're making. So I always give a long answer. I'm sorry about that.
Don't worry.
Yes, feedback is essential to being a really good teacher. That's one of the essential aspects. But let's say a higher aspect of that is the deep knowledge of both didactics, teaching as a profession, and on the other hand, the domain in which you're teaching. Combine those two, and then you're capable of giving good lessons, choosing the right tasks, giving the right feedback, and all of those types of things.
What I love about that as well, Paul, is it although some of those are quite global ideas, they're actually quite tangible as well. They're quite achievable. We've got two concepts there, which is to have high levels of conceptual understanding and knowledge within a subject domain, and that skill or that toolkit of being the teacher in the room. Yeah. And I think we all know that intuitively, don't we? We all know that they're the two precious items that we have, and presumably then a lot of our systems need to be much, much more coherent at addressing those skill sets.
Definitely.
Okay, so let's move on here. We're going to introduce a few terms to the listener here. For you, Paul, what distinguishes feed up, feedback, and feed forward?
Okay, I mean, the words just about say itself. Feed up is that which you do prior to the task. Feed back is what's after, and feed forward is during the process itself. So, and it makes it, it sounds very strange, but the words themselves say what it is, and those are three different aspects of giving what we call, at one point, only feedback, but what Hattie and Timperley discuss as three different aspects. What are you going to do? How are you doing it? How are you doing it? And then reflecting back upon it, how did you do it? Those are the three aspects of it.
So it's interesting again, because therefore, presumably then we need to be thinking about a type of structure or a type of learning model which enables those behaviors to actually be incorporated within the learning cycle.
Yeah. I mean, the simple and the long and the short answer is yes, we have to think about that. Yeah.
Okay, so in terms of levels of feedback questions, Paul, obviously we're talking about Hattie and Timperley a little bit already, but what are the different levels of feedback questions, and how can teachers become more effective at using those different levels?
Yeah, well, I mean, the question of effective is learning the techniques on the one hand and having the deep conceptual knowledge of the domain. I have a bit of a problem with Hattie and Timperley calling them levels. I call them aspects, because levels kind of implies that there's a hierarchical nature, although they're more, you could call them more heterarchical, at the same level, serving different goals, different needs. So you have it at the task level, so that you're giving feedback with respect to that which the person is doing, how well, how is it understood? Is it understood? So you're giving feedback with respect to that. You also can do it what they call at the process level. I call it the process aspect. And that's more, how are you doing it? What do you need to know in order to do it? And that's also by the feed forward, feed through, and feedback. All three of those things is how you're doing it. At the self, the third is the self-regulation aspect. By saying to someone only that's right or that's wrong, you're not helping them monitor their own learning, directing their own learning, regulating the actions that they're carrying out. You have to get them to think about it. So you have to that's the whole idea behind these epistemic questions. Going back to cooking, if you go to a vocational high school or college and you learn how to cook, you've learned the things that you need and you can cook in Salisbury or in Amsterdam. But if you go and you do an internship in Chamonix or in Crested Butte, Colorado, the bread, the cakes, all of the spaghetti that you're making all won't work. The reason it won't work is because at 3,000 meters, water boils at a lower temperature, and the air, because of the air pressure, which is less, the atmospheric pressure, and that means that gases expand more greatly. That means your cakes and your breads will blow up, and your pasta will not ever get more than al dente, even if it gets that way. So what you want with this self-regulation is that someone looks at it and says, hey, there's something going on here. What's now the difference between where I learned it and where I am? Oh yeah, I already had in physics, I learned something about air pressure and that has to mark the Boyle's law, whatever, all of those types of things. That's the self-reflection. But the only way you can do that is if you create tasks in which you not only ask someone for, like, what's the recipe for baking a cake, but you ask them, if you were now in Chamonix, would this recipe work? And why or why not? You teach the exact same thing, but you ask them to think about it, to reflect on it. And in doing so, they not only will possibly, with your help, come up with the right answers and understand it, and not only see it as a kind of like a knee-jerk reflex, okay, this is the formula if you're at 3,000 meters or something like that. So that's not the only effect of doing that. But what you also teach them is that for the future, that which they've learned today is not even enough for acting today, let alone in 5 or 10 years when we don't know what the future will bring and there are new types of jobs and things like that. The major problem is people are lulled into this sense of security that what I've learned is enough for what I'm doing. And what you want to do with your teaching, with that self-reflection and reaching that level, is to have them also understand what you've learned today is maybe enough for working in Salisbury or in London, but definitely isn't enough if you're working there or there or there or there. Yeah. So you want to do that with the self, let's say the self-regulation level, and also to say that self level, which is the final one, and that's where we now we're going back full circle, that the person who's learning gets the experience of, hey, I can do it. I've come further. This idea of self-efficacy. Hey, I can do it. I'm not dumb. One of the major problems is we've given feedback in such a way that people have the idea, I can't do it. Mm. And what you want to do with good feedback is to help them and give them the idea that they can do it. Not only give them the idea, let them experience that they can do it. Because everybody can. You may have to make the learning steps smaller. You know, just like a child can't walk up a normal stair, you should have stairs for children which the steps are closer to each other. Then they experience, I can walk up the steps. Yeah, now you want them to do this. So sometimes you'll need to make smaller steps. But the idea is to constantly help people to learn, have them reach the step more quickly, and have them stay on the step for a shorter period of time.
Brilliant. I think it's such a great analogy, Paul. I really like that. And what I really like about what you said there is it's really aspirational. We're really challenging the ideas of some can and some can't. We're getting closer to the idea of if we can't in the moment, the task might not be quite right.
Yeah. I mean, it's not to say that everyone can. I will never be able to compose like Bach did. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'll definitely won't be able to curl it like Beckham. Yeah. I can learn to do things. I play baseball and things like that. Everybody can learn to their level. Yeah. Yeah. And so there are differences between people, and not all of us will become prodigies or become a quantum physicist, but that doesn't really matter. But the idea is everyone, if you do it properly, can achieve success in the fields that they're learning and working in.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting.
To their level of optimal or maximal proficiency. And feedback is a very powerful tool in both helping them get there, but also in not knocking them down so that they'll stop trying to achieve.
Now, we've talked about limitations there, and we even sort of touched briefly there on the idea of feedback potentially being a little damaging even. I mean, Shank discussed the types of feedback that can limit learning. Now, if we look at things like threats and discouragement, I don't think there's anyone's going to be surprised that that type of feedback is going to limit people. But Shank also recognized praise and reward could be limiting forms of feedback.
There's been quite a lot of research on it, and it depends upon the type of praise that you give. Praise in general leads to the idea that you can do everything. So the praise that you give needs to be specific. That is what you have done properly. That's kind of like the problem that people say we see with the younger generation, that they're praised into the sky's the limit for just trying. And that tends to lead to people who get discouraged and frustrated very, very quickly, which will have a negative effect. So the praise that you need to give, in any of it, the most recent research, and almost all of it shows, has to be very task specific. Yes, Johnny or Mary, you've done this and this well, and this was good, and not you're good. There's a difference between you did this well or you're good. And so praise can be specific or general, and it's been shown that general praise tends to lead to learning problems, but also leads to frustration, giving up, and things like that. Whereas specific praise gives someone the feeling of self-efficacy, the idea I can do it, and will encourage them to attempt to do something else or do it again or go to a different level. So they have to just be very, very careful in what you're doing. And we tend to, at this moment, be over effusive, I think that's a word in English.
Yes.
In the praise that we give, a very general phrase. Everything is good.
I really like the usability of that as well, Paul, because I mean, I'm just putting it into my own words here as I listen. And what came into my mind was, by all means, praise the learning behavior. By all means, praise the process as you
know.
But just praising the individual might not particularly.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what quite a lot of recent empirical research has shown, that that's exactly the case.
So you very kindly earlier mentioned the idea of corrective, directive, and how do you pronounce this? Epistemic or epistemic?
Epistemic. Yeah, I think you as Brits would call it epistemic.
Epistemic. I've heard it on numerous occasions online referred to as epistemic, so I didn't want to offend.
But it's because it's the epistemology.
Yes.
I have the short E. Brits say things.
We get it wrong. But it
doesn't matter. Some people say efficacy, others say efficacy. Potato, potato, tomato, tomato. Let's call the whole thing off.
That's a pretty good
point. I'm not going to break into song. My voice is not something that you want to hear on a podcast.
Well, we're certainly aligned on that one, because mine is also somewhat dreadful. So just give us again a synopsis of corrective, directive, and epistemic then.
Corrective says if it's right or wrong.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of the thing that also these drill and practice computer programmers, yes, it's wrong. Sometimes with yes, whoopee, and bells and things go off and that type of thing. Directive is actually only when it's wrong and it tells you how to do it properly. So you do possibly learn how to do it, but it's cheap. Let's call it that. It also gives the idea that there's only one way to do it, and it makes also someone dependent on others. So if I didn't learn it, I'll learn it in this way. But in any event, hopefully you'll learn from it without really thinking about it. Let's call it that. And epistemic or epistemic is feedback that gets you to think about it. So like if someone hands in a project about building a bridge, and the bridge might be saying, okay, yeah, really nice, the bridge will probably do that, but could you have done it differently? Might there have been a different foundation? Get you thinking about, okay, what type of soil is it, and could we have done it a different way, so that you think farther than that which you've done. And that's the true learning sense, reflecting upon what you've done, how you've done it, and how you might have done it differently, whether doing it differently would lead to another result, lead to a quicker result, lead to a more effective result, all those types of things. And so that's the optimal learning feedback for me is epistemic feedback. It asks more from the teacher. It asks more from the learner. And then you have to do something with that feedback, not just put it on a piece of paper that it gets in someone's book bag and never looked at. Do something with the feedback. If you don't, as a teacher, do something with the feedback, then why should a student do anything with the feedback that you've given? Mm-hmm. So you have to then expand upon it and make it a complete learning process.
But very interesting. I was sitting here in 2018. We're on a Zoom call. We're recording this, Paul. Technology is part of our lives, right? There's no doubt about that. And I see also in your history, in your profession as well, you've obviously addressed these points. So let's just take technology then. Does it offer a useful aid in providing single corrective feedback?
Oh, single corrective feedback is simple. I mean, yes or no, that's even the most drill and practice computer programs. Do that. If you've conjugated the verb improperly, it'll tell you yes, you've done it right, or no, you've done it wrong. And if you've done it wrong, you have to try it again. That leads to trial and error often.
I mean, Paul, is there an argument there that that is the most efficient way of getting corrective feedback because it's immediate, because it's automated?
Now, it depends upon it's in any event for the teacher, not time consuming. Mm. It can be done individually by the student. You don't learn very much from it. The learning process takes longer because you're not getting any feedback as to what you're doing wrong. Yeah. So if you're constantly guessing and being told you're wrong, eventually, if there are only four choices, you'll get the right one. Indeed. And if it's an open question, you know, when you just fill in one word there, it might take you even longer. Yeah. If you only get the corrective feedback, because you finally have the idea, well, I'll never learn it because I'm constantly getting it wrong. Of course, you're constantly getting wrong. Nobody's helping you to learn how to do it. Hmm. So in the short run, it might sound very effective, but it's not very effective for learning.
Very interesting. So therefore, the question must be posed then, What about technology and IT and its use with directive and epistemic? Where do you sit on that one?
I think the technology at this moment is too dumb. I don't have a clear crystal ball. I don't know if and when it will no longer be that dumb. We see things like machine learning, which can bring a computer to learn to play Go at the level of a chess master within one day, whereas we used to have to program Deep Blue for years before it could beat a chess master. That's the difference in it. It can reach it, but at this moment, it's still fairly dumb. So in the future, it will possibly be able to play a role, but then it's going to reach, it will have to, I think, reach the stage. Well, for directive, it's not so hard, although you have to program it to do that. Because you can, even with respect to, okay, you did it wrong. You should have done it this way. Yeah. I mean, if there is only one way to do it, yeah, to solve a quadratic equation or to bake cake, then it's not very hard to do it. If there's more than one, you can also program it to understand system fault. I say in Dutch, system mistakes. And we see that in addition, for example, if you're adding things up or subtracting, the people forget to decrease the tens column by one if they have to borrow from it. And you can see by the type of answer that they gave that it was the wrong way. So you can give directive and say, no, you're supposed to do it this way. What you did wrong is you forgot to decrease the tens column width and things like that. That's programmable. So you can even reach that stage. But you have to do a good cognitive task analysis to program it in that way if you want to do it. To go to a triple loop, the why questions, that requires the computer to be at the stage that it can almost think.
Yeah.
And we're getting there with AI, and we're getting there with machine learning. But we're not there yet, and we haven't achieved it in the situation that you can use it in education. But as I said, I don't have a crystal ball, so I don't know when we'll receive it. I don't know if typing something in, if the computer can't understand natural language, because what you want to do as a teacher, you want to think, could you have done it a different way? And so that's normally an intercourse between, or discourse between the teacher and the learner. That means that the computers would also have to be able to do that and create that feeling and understanding in it. But it might be possible in the future. I won't rule anything out. I mean, 30 years ago, I didn't think I would be walking around with in my pocket with a computer that's more powerful than that which sent people to the moon.
Indeed.
You know, and I couldn't have thought of that. So who knows?
It's an interesting one. I mean, I was reading actually this morning, 10 years ago, the first Wi-Fi enabled iPod was released, for example. Now that seems, in terms of technology, seems millennia ago almost. I mean, it seems a long time ago, but it's as recent as 10 years. But what I take from your answer there, Paul, or my personal interpretation there, is that technology has a role and it can certainly aid in the feedback process to a certain degree.
To a certain extent.
But ultimately, we need the master teacher. We need the true, as you mentioned earlier, the true notion of the expert teacher.
I mean, you can also have, I work with computer-supported collaborative learning, and you can, for example, give certain types of process feedback at this moment to the learner, because not all too intelligent computer is capable of seeing what percent of the time in a group one or another person is talking. So it can give you a feedback with respect to who's talking the most and who's talking the least, which can kind of like in a car, which, you know, that the speedometer tells you you're going too fast, which can give you a signal from, hey, you're talking too much, let someone else, you know, type of thing. So, I mean, it you can use technology also for those types of things to give a process, certain types of process feedback. It doesn't mean that the person who's been talking the most has said the most intelligent things. The computer is not far enough, or the technology we have at the moment is not capable of saying he's been talking quite a lot, but he's been saying smart things, or he's been talking very little, but said the most important thing. Yeah, those are the types of things that the computer can't do. They can only tell you, are you going too fast? Is your engine turning with too many RPMs? Those are the things it can tell you, but not very much more. And sometimes that's important. Absolutely. And can be important. So I won't play it down, but I also won't play it up.
It made my mind jump to the analogy again in football of becoming obsessed with possession statistics.
Exactly. So like,
we got loads of possession.
Yeah.
But we lost 2-0.
But look what happened to Spain.
Indeed.
You know, against, was it Russia?
Yes, right. Yeah.
They had like 70% ball.
82, I think it was.
Yeah, something. And I mean, it's great to have the ball the whole time. And Johan Cruyff once said, as long as you have the ball, the other one can't have it. But if you don't score, if it's not effective, I'm not talking about efficient, a counter is efficient. But if it's not effective ball control, if it's just playing the ball back and forth, you're not going to score a goal.
Well said.
And you're definitely not going to win then.
Indeed, and they didn't.
They didn't.
Well, as you know, I have a little Spanish heritage or a little Spanish family connection, and that led to some long conversations about Spanish style in football. So, I mean, one of the things that again draws into my mind, Paul, is that for us, or for educators, in order to give really sharp and relevant feedback to learners, learners need to have some notion of what their goal is, what they're trying to reach, where they're going with this. So to what extent do learners need to understand and own their learning goals for feedback to be effective?
But that's true of all education. I mean, if you start on something, it has to be clear where you're going, why you're going there. There's been so much research on the use of learning objectives, the giving of goals, that it's for me a no-brainer. If you don't know where you're supposed to go I mean, if we go into those levels that we were talking about, okay, the self-regulation level, yeah, self-monitoring, how can you monitor your progress if you don't know where you're going? I mean, that's like getting in a car and driving somewhere, and you don't know if you're getting closer or not. You don't know if the left turn or the right turn was good or not because you have no idea where you're going. So if you don't let people know where they're supposed to be going, it's impossible to say whether the process is a good process. It's impossible to regulate, to monitor your learning process, your driving process, your cooking process, whatever process, if you don't know where the process is supposed to end up. So it's for me, it's like, duh, it's a no-brainer. And I don't mean it towards you, but the teacher that doesn't tell his or her students where they're going and why, yeah.
And that why one gets missed out quite a lot, right? Yeah. We often, the lesson objective or the scheme of assessment shows us where we're going, but it doesn't always give the context, I think. I mean, I've
yeah. Many and it is, I mean, sometimes the why might be so abstract that it's hard to say. Yeah. And we don't only learn mathematics to be able to count our change, you know? It's sometimes because in order to do the next step, yeah, yes, you have to know if an ammeter is in series or parallel, not because it's important, period. It's because if you want to eventually measure the current going through something, you have to hook it up properly. And I could give you incredible whys in terms of the flow of electrons, you know, but I mean, the idea of if you're giving someone a task, you're doing it for a reason as a teacher. What's the problem to tell the learner the exact same thing?
I agree.
So they know where they're going because you want to get them, you want that process. It's not the product, it's the process. So you want them to be able to monitor their own learning. To monitor your own learning, it means, am I getting closer to where I'm supposed to be? You can only do that if you know where you're supposed to be. If you don't know that, you can't do that.
I couldn't agree more, and you're right to say it in that way, Paul. I think I think you almost hesitated to say it in the Dura way, but I think we need to clarify these points. I think
let's keep it as concrete and as simple as possible.
Absolutely.
If someone says, they say, duh, no brainer, of course.
Well said. Now, we mentioned earlier, didn't we, about almost building in time for feedback to be utilized. And I mean, and if feedback isn't used by the learner, then its value decreases. So how can teachers, and perhaps more importantly, how can curriculum planners ensure that learners have as much time as possible?
As much time as possible. That's for curriculum. I'd like to keep it at the level of the teacher.
Please.
Okay. And that means, and the same thing with homework. If you give homework and as a teacher don't do anything, just put a mark on it, a number or a check or whatever, then the goal is just getting your homework done. Yeah? The whole idea behind giving homework, giving feedback on what's done, is that the student afterwards does something with it. But that means for a teacher, you have the responsibility of making sure they do something with it. So if you give feedback on something that someone's written, you need them to do something with it, either answer the questions you've given them or rewrite it in a way that solves the problems that you've done. Or if you've given them epistemic feedback, think about, is there another way? Do something with it. Give a quiz based upon the feedback that you've given to them, base assignments on it. Do something with the feedback. And of course that takes time, but that's part of the learning process. Learning takes time. Yeah? But if you're not going to do anything with the feedback, you might as well not give it, because the student will not do it. They'll look at it and say, oh, I got in this mark, this was wrong, okay, because the teacher didn't do anything with it. So what's the sense of giving it if you're not going to do anything with it? What's the sense of expecting the learner to do something with it if you as a teacher don't do anything with it? Teach them that receiving feedback is to improve the process and eventually get better marks and all of those types of things, those are the products, but do something with it. If you don't do anything with it, Don't expect the learner to do anything with it. And so I'd say, then don't give it. I mean, it's that simple. Then it's a complete waste of time.
Well said, Paul. I'd like to wrap up that short commentary and take it with me everywhere in the different domains that I work in.
Very, very
valuable. So just picking up, I mean, if we pick up on Butler et al.'s work a moment, that research specified when feedback should be given. So when should feedback be provided to learners?
As quickly, as close to the learning experience as possible. It's that simple. You kick a ball today, and in a week, your coach comes back and says, you kicked it wrong. Do you think that will help you learn how to kick the ball better? When will it help? After you've kicked the ball, the coach comes over and says, no, you hit it with the point of your toe instead of your instep. If you want to curl it, you need your instep because you've got to get a spin on it. That also gives the why. That's more directive feedback. Yeah? And that is it. When? Immediately afterwards. Not like, remember a week ago when you kicked the ball? Did you kick it with your instep or with your toe? And it's, the timing is everything. As quickly as possible, as constructive as possible. Sometimes I think we make, we tend to make things more difficult than they actually are. If you just think about a normal area, it's a no-brainer to say you need the feedback as quickly as possible. You don't want your room, to heat up a week after it gets the signal that it's too cold.
It's like making a substitute in the 96th minute when the whistle blew in the 95th, right?
It can work. Louis van Gaal did that in the 96th minute and brought in a new keeper, goalkeeper, because the keeper that he had wasn't a very good penalty stopper.
I see.
So actually in the 126th minute, after the two extra periods of 15 minutes, brought in right before the game ended, got rid of his keeper that was there for 125 and a half minutes and put in a different keeper for the penalties.
Did they win?
And the Netherlands won.
Oh, wow. He
not
saved
only
some.
Because he was a better keeper, but he also intimidated the other team. It's kind of like, oh, man, they're bringing in a penalty stopper.
Special teams.
Yeah. Special teams.
Special teams. Interesting. So, let's have a bit of a think about this. So Shank and Shute seem to suggest to us that feedback should be different from novice and expert learners. Is that the case, and how so?
All teaching should be different for novices and experts. Mm-hmm. It's that simple. Slava Kaljuga called that the expertise reversal effect. That means that certain things that work for novices either won't work or could be deleterious to experts. And those things that are good for experts either don't work or can be deleterious to novices. So it's always the case. An expert is not just a novice with more knowledge. They have different cognitive schemes. They see the world differently. They think differently. And if they think differently, that means that their process of solving a problem is different. So you need to cater to it. Then you don't go into the simple steps in it because you realize they've already internalized steps and they've jumped across six steps in it. Whereas that giving that type of feedback to a novice who has to take it step for step for step and think about each of those steps with a high degree of cognitive load and things like that, you have to give them specific feedback which will bring them further. And it's not a dichotomy of expert and novice because you have all different degrees, but it's it is the case that feedback for an expert and a novice should differ because they think differently. Their thinking process is different. And as their thinking process is different and feedback is supposed to affect the process and not the product, you need to give feedback not based upon what the product is, but based upon what the process was. And so it's, again, I won't call it a no-brainer, but it's, for me, it's very evident that feedback has to fit the level of expertise of the learner.
So individualization is clearly important here.
To a certain extent, I mean, yeah. You can't do it for 30, but you know, like there are certain aspects. If you've got a group of learners who are just beginning to make use of the Pythagorean theorem, you'll see that some of them have learned it. They don't need any feedback. They've done it properly and in the way it's supposed to be. But certain won't. But that's quite different if you're dealing with an expert mathematician who's doing something different. You have to do it. You have to be careful that you don't make it impossible for the teacher. But it's something that the teacher has to think about and has to follow and understand the process that the student has followed. That's why the epistemic questions are good.
Yeah.
How did you carry it out? Why did you solve it in this way? Then you get to understand the way of thinking, the process of thinking, which then allows you, as an expert in the domain that you're teaching, to come into that process and give the proper feedback. But you have to understand that process, and it takes time and interaction with the learner. So, yeah.
Fascinating stuff. So look, in the article there, you posed the question, do feedback givers give feedback and then build in a mechanism to check if the feedback was acted upon? Do they check if the same mistake is made by the learner repeatedly? So I'd like to pose that back to you, Paul. Should feedback givers be achieving that? Is that the aim?
You want to see what the effects of what you're doing. I mean, as a teacher, you're giving feedback to help people learn and to improve the learning process. You can go ahead, with a one-track mind, not seeing whether or not it's been achieved, but that's not teaching.
Is that what we call delivering? I hear this word a lot.
That's pure delivery.
Delivering.
But that's not teaching. And part of teaching can be delivery. I mean, giving a good lecture is great.
Absolutely.
But afterwards, seeing whether or not it came across and it was understood, and what was understood, and what wasn't understood, and why wasn't it understood, and the reason why it wasn't understood isn't by definition because the learner wasn't listening or was stupid or whatever. It could be that you delivered it wrong. So the feedback is not only important for the learner, but also for the instructor. I mean, the most important feedback from if you give an examination is if 80% of the students got the question wrong, you probably taught it incorrectly. Either the question was bad or you taught it incorrectly. Yeah, and it's that type of thing. So doing something with it means that you are more aware of what your teaching is achieving, and what's going well and what's going wrong, but you're also in both what you do and what the learner is doing. And so that's, it's, yeah. If you don't care what effect it has, why do it?
Indeed. Again, such a simple reminder to us all. But again, do we sometimes as educators in busy schools, but do we just get lost in the idea of I have to deliver this course and I have to follow this process? And I think sometimes day-to-day trivialities can lead to that kind of covering one's back.
And to a certain extent, can you blame some teachers if that's the way they're evaluated? By the number of the students who get this or that mark, then your goal is the product of getting this or that mark and not learning. But that's a completely other area in which we're talking about complete educational reform, and let's not go into that now.
Something tells me we may return to that conversation.
Okay, we'll see.
So this is a huge question, and please forgive me for asking it as my final question to you, Paul. Okay. At the end of your article, you wrote, the right feedback at the right time, acted upon by the learner, works. To put it simply, no feedback means no learning. If you were to design a classroom to this end, how would the classroom work? And I must add, Paul, something you may have just caught in the background. our studio here is very close to a very large airfield, and we have the quite famous Farnborough Air Show starting today.
Okay, let's get it done quickly then.
In case you hear a rumble, that's what it is.
Okay. I can give you a long answer, but we've been busy now for almost an hour, and I think your listeners are kind of getting tired of my voice. If I was to design a classroom to this end, how would this classroom work? It would be an environment in which teachers and students had an optimal opportunity to provide each other with feedback, create a learning, an optimal learning process. And that means you can set it up for the teacher giving students feedback, students giving each other feedback, peer teaching, peer learning, those types of things. But to create an environment in which, number one, there is an optimal opportunity and amount of feedback, and point two, that creates a certain degree of psychological safety in the student, in the learner, that he or she is not afraid of making a mistake, because making a mistake is part of the learning process.
Yes.
And that's something we often forget. You hear people talking, for me, the stupidity of saying teaching creativity, it's a 21st century skill. Again, I think we've had that since
like collaboration,
Mesopotamia.
Yeah.
When someone saw grass and thought we can make grain from this, the person was very creative then. But you can't teach creativity. That's part of our nature. What you can do is create either an environment that will stimulate creativity or will be deleterious to creativity. If you create an environment in which thinking outside of the normal lines is punished, either physically, psychologically, or whatever, you'll have people who won't be creative and won't think outside of the lines. Hey, that's wrong. You should have painted it this way or done it that way. If you create an environment where those types of things are possible, it will lead to creativity. In any event, not stifle creativity and maybe stimulate people to think in a creative way. So you can't teach it. You can create an environment that can stimulate it. It's the same thing here. If you want to make optimal use of feedback, as in the learning process, you have to create an environment where there's the psychological safety of, if I made a mistake, that's part of the learning process, and that's why my co-students, my teacher, is there to help me in that process towards learning. And that's what a classroom should look like. And not a bunch of friends, because an authentic teacher, PhD of mine did that, is seen by students as someone who really knows his or her area and has a distance, a professional distance, to the students back and forth, but in an environment in which these types of things, yeah, making mistakes, thinking, reflecting, doing it better, is accepted and rewarded, and is not punished or not accepted.
Well said.
Create that environment.
Well said, Paul. I think there's clearly pressures which sometimes can, if we assume them to be constant, can restrict these kinds of behaviors. But I think what that is, it's a magnificent reminder what is at the heart of our successful processes. If we value true learning, true experience of developing the capacity of human beings in their learning potential. So I think it's a magnificent reminder, Paul. I feel truly privileged to have had this conversation with you. I thank you.
Thank you very, very much.
It was very deep.
My pleasure indeed.
You're a real gentleman, and I must repeat something I said before. Thank you for being straight, because I think it's something that sometimes we need to hear it that way. We need a reminder. We need a jolt. We need a flick on the ear, whatever analogy you want, just yeah, to remind us of the importance and often the simplicity of the most central and important facts. And I thank you greatly for that.
Johan Cruyff said a number of things, but one of them was, when I go and I look at 150 pupils, how do I know who I should choose to come to my team? His answer to that was, I look at their intention. If they know where to play the ball, I can teach anyone to kick a ball over 20 or 30 meters to the right person, but I can't teach them who's the right person. Yeah. So that's kind of the situation here. What you need to do is create a climate that someone doesn't feel bad about kicking the ball to the wrong person, but that they know to whom they should be kicking it. That's the way you get good soccer players.
Brilliant, Paul. I've been pushing up and down my my volume on my microphone because we have these crazy. I think that I just had the Eurofighter go over our head. It gets very loud.
Oh,
here.
I didn't hear it, so you did it very, very well.
I'm trying. These are the sliders on mixers. I'm only just becoming used to. Paul, once again, thank you. Do please stay on the line as I hit stop on the recording just now, and we'll sign off in person.
Okay.
Paul, on behalf of my whole team here at the Everlearner Classroom, the teacher in Classroom 21. Thank you. And we very much look forward to speaking to you again.
Okay. Thank you very much. My pleasure.